From deep in the wilds of Pittsfield Township, Michigan, it's the Grace and Paul Pottscast. She's a left-wing conservative Catholic homeschooler who loves to garden. He's a bearded computer geek who reads and writes like he's running out of time. Together, they're raising an ever-growing army of adorkable children and planning the revolution. All right. We have a guest who was kind enough to join us on very short notice.
Yes.
And we've been talking about having him on for a long time, but we got to find someone who...
Somebody.
Special moment, yeah. Frame of mind you have to be.
Who can join us. So this is Elias Krim.
And you're Skyping in from Valparaiso?
Happily Skyping in from leafy Valparaiso, Indiana.
Marvelous.
Great to reconnect with you guys. Haven't talked to you in a while.
Yeah. No, it's, I think, too long, actually.
Yeah. Elias just commented when I sent him a note on Facebook Messenger that it looks like the last time we spoke was 2014.
Yeah. A little while.
At least on Facebook Messenger.
Right. Yeah. And I think the last time I saw Elias was last fall.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's been a little while. I think it was the front porch, the FPR conference.
Yeah. When you guys crashed here and all that. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, no. Yeah, this was last September.
Or was it a year ago?
It was a year ago. It was like a year ago. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. All right.
And that was in, I think, Holland, Michigan. Yes. Okay. Yeah, I'm there.
That's right.
Am I doing that with the cord?
Yes.
Sorry, I'll stop.
Don't do that with the cord.
No fidgeting.
I'm fidgeting with the cord. Yeah. Sorry, everyone. That was me.
Can you come up with a good introduction for
I think I can. Elias is the founder and principal at Solidarity Hall.
Yes.
And it is a publishing house, blog, podcast, writing platform exploring the common good.
Perennial mystery.
Yes. It's a perennial mystery of what the common good even is and how to support it. So, and really how we need to turn our attention in these times to support the common good. Is that fair?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. I think that's an apt description, but I'm hoping Elias can flesh that out for us more.
Yes.
Yes. That's actually kind of sort of the idea.
But yeah, if this was a talk, someone would have to read like a brief introduction.
Yes. So there's that.
Everyone would be tapping their fingers waiting for it to be over.
So, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. So this is the part where I'm supposed to say, yes, but do we do anything, you know?
there's that. But you do. I know you're busy in Valparaiso.
I am. Yeah. Grace, thanks. many not really related to Solidarity Hall, other than sort of fodder, you know, for the blog, I guess, which is okay.
Yeah.
I would say in a general way, what we've been doing the last year or two is just trying to figure out how Solidarity Hall can touch the ground.
Mm-hmm.
What would that mean? And so we've made a few experiments. The notable one, I would say, was our attempt to do some community microfunding dinners in the region.
Oh.
I have been watching Detroit for a while, and the project there called Detroit Soup.
Yes.
And so we knocked off Detroit Soup. And Shore Soup.
The what soup?
South Shore.
Because we're South Shore.
Yeah. So we did one in Michigan City, and we did one in Gary. And this has been now over a year and a half ago. So we had nice turnouts for both. We had people from the immediate vicinity from the neighborhood come in and for 3 or 4 minutes pitch an idea. And then the winner.
We're getting Elias. We're getting a really bad audio. It's just breaking down into like robot tones.
And, yeah.
Let me see if our housemate is streaming TV.
Oh, and slowing down our connection.
Let me see if she could. Let me just check.
Yeah. And is there anything like a connection on your end maybe that could be a little loose?
No, it's internet. It's internet. That's internet weather, I think. Hang on.
Internet weather.
How weird.
That's a word. That's a phrase. Internet weather.
That's unfortunate.
I'm not ready. I'm not ready for this world, Elias. what am I supposed to do?
It cleared up as soon as I left, didn't it?
Of course.
Okay. our housemate isn't streaming anything. The kids aren't watching YouTube videos or whatever. So
okay. Well,
I will just say it was a glitch and hope it doesn't come back.
Well, tell us about your South Shore, or is it South Shore?
Shore Soup.
Soup. Yeah. Okay.
It is an attempt to knock off a good idea, which was Detroit Soup. Detroit Soup, they've been doing it for 7 or 8 years, I think.
A while now, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. They've raised like somewhere between $150,000 and $200,000.
Yes.
$5 at a time.
It's the best way to do it.
They have started businesses. They mm-hmm. have started nonprofits. They mm-hmm. have started neighborhood projects. They have started bad ideas that didn't get anywhere.
Which is actually the most important part.
It is.
Right. Rule out, yeah, make your mistakes early and often.
And
creative
cheaply.
Destruction.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Do something
cheap,
really
cool.
See if it doesn't
work. You can go on the Detroit Soup website and download the spreadsheet of every presentation, kind of a little description of it, mm-hmm. The basics that's ever been given. So I don't know what number it is. It's in the hundreds. So and as you read through them, they are just a spectacular little seedbed of things.
Seedbed of ideas, right?
Yeah, right. And so, you know, like I say, many of them did not work, but many did. And now soup is an international thing.
Mm-hmm.
For some strange reason, it's very popular in the UK. There are many soup events in the UK.
Mm-hmm.
So we did one in Michigan City. We did one in Gary. We had a nice turnout and several nice projects got started. And then I realized the missing piece, which I'm still working on.
Mm-hmm.
And that is, just as in Detroit, we didn't really have a way to do kind of a handoff from the soup evening to something else, you know, the incubator.
Oh,
you got this
okay.
good idea, but, you know, can you do it on your own, really? Okay. So right. we can point you to a few people, but will that be enough? And do you know about how to organize a project? Do you know how to organize a nonprofit? You know, there's all kinds of stuff.
Mm-hmm. Right. So sort of like a support, like some support scaffolding.
Yeah, follow up, kind of the next phase to really incubate the idea, some of which was needed, not always, but mm-hmm. we didn't really have it in place. But it just occurred to me that it seems to me that there needs to be a system where not only do you get great ideas from the neighborhood at the soup, but then mm-hmm. those ideas have a place to go and get developed and mm-hmm. then really put on the road for hopefully longer term.
Mm-hmm.
So that was one thing. And we're not done with that. And Pete Davis, who just graduated from law school, is going back with his shiny law degree
mm-hmm.
to Falls Church, Virginia.
All right.
His hometown.
Mm-hmm.
And his idea, among other things, is to create some kind of a C-lab, maybe even to do soup-like projects. So we're thinking if we had one in Northwest Indiana and one in Falls Church, Virginia,
mm-hmm.
maybe we have the beginnings of something larger.
Yeah.
We don't know.
Yeah. We'll see. Right. Open up what a C-Lab is for our listeners. What's a C-Lab?
It's just my made-up term for a community incubator. And by that, I mean a place where you create civic entrepreneurs.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Okay, mm-hmm. So how many of those are there? You know, the answer is basically none.
They don't exist.
Civic entrepreneurship, I think I invented the phrase, frankly, because mm-hmm. I just can't find it. You could call it social entrepreneur, which is pretty much the same thing.
Right. Give us, for instance, what would that look like? What would a civic entrepreneur, like a project he or she might do?
Well, that's interesting. I've got sort of two frames of mind about this. My mm-hmm. original one was sort of a goo-goo idea. The term goo-goo comes from Chicago. Mm-hmm. It comes from the old Mayor Daley, who was very annoyed with people who would come up from Hyde Park and want to talk about good government. He hated these people. He called them goo-goos.
The goo-goos.
Mm-hmm. That's all he wanted to talk about was good government. You know, he just wanted to kill them all. Anyway, so the goo-goo idea is you're a citizen, you're a good person, you want to organize something, you are going to help the city, you're mm-hmm. going to collaborate with City Hall, mm-hmm. and we're going to get something done that otherwise the city would not get around to, doesn't have the budget for, doesn't know how to do.
Doesn't even have the energy for, yeah.
Nah. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, the city being the city mm-hmm. is kind of wary. They're going to wait and watch you do it. And if you get it right, then maybe we'll collaborate and probably take all the credit anyway.
Yeah, the right. usual.
So that's mm-hmm. that's what a civic entrepreneur is.
Right.
I've refined the idea a bit in order to make it a little bit more of a challenge to the city rather than, a kind of cheerful sort of Boy Scout kind of collaboration.
Right. Where it's more like it's the citizen who gets bike lanes installed for the first time.
Yes, that's right. The original idea. Right. Sort of tactical urbanism, you know, all that good stuff.
It's the person who's like that empty lot maybe could be a pocket park.
Yeah. Yeah, right. And that's great, and that's a whole lot of it. But yeah. I'm learning mm-hmm. that when you look around in Europe, in particular, and other places, there's more going on. There's another level of this, mm-hmm. and it really has to do with the rise of kind of like fearless cities. Mm-hmm. Chuck Marone, I believe, was just going to a conference, I think, called Fearless Cities. There's also
mm-hmm.
kind of rising cities. Mm-hmm. There is, in fact, when you dig a little deeper, you discover there is a very fascinating movement now called municipalism. Mm. And that is what's going on, among other places, in Barcelona, Spain, and in Rojava, Kurdistan.
Kurdistan.
Wow.
Yeah. And so idea with municipalism is that... Is it like organizing at the municipal level?
Correct.
Versus a federally or on a county or state level?
That's right.
Okay.
It is essentially self-organizing communities mm-hmm. That in some ways, and this is where it kind of turned my head around, they are organizing in the sense that they are beginning to offer an alternative citizenship.
Oh, hey.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. So I first got a signal of this when I learned that in New York and in San Francisco, mm-hmm. and somewhat to my surprise, in South Bend, Indiana, you can get
South Bend.
a civic ID.
Right.
Wow.
So an ID from the municipality, from the city.
And you don't even have to be a federal citizen mm-hmm. or even documented. You simply have to be a resident.
Right. You live here.
You live here. And if you get a card, you're entitled to certain things, no matter what anybody else outside the city might say, which
right.
is a pretty interesting idea.
It's a radical form of home rule, actually.
Wow.
It is.
Yeah.
And actually, it sounds like anarchism, but not scary.
Well, I'm thinking of, okay, so I hope that doesn't get confused with like the sovereign citizens movement,
no.
right?
No.
And here's why. Because there's a very important piece of it. There's also a thing called dark municipalism, which is the bad stuff. That means, by the way, merely autarky. That's not what
self-rule.
We're talking about.
Self-rule, right.
No. And this has to be to work, confederalism.
Right.
Which means New York and San Francisco and South Bend and everybody else, they're collaborating. They're creating a system amongst themselves.
Hmm. Right.
Wow.
So that's really interesting. There's a lot of talk and discussion around this. There's a really kind of interesting character who's behind it. Mm-hmm. And in typical Solidarity Hall fashion, mm-hmm. we have to find, kind of a presiding spirit, an intellectual who got all this going.
Right.
Well, his name is Murray Bookchin.
No,
Murray
Bookchin.
Yeah.
And Murray Bookchin is actually kind of famous in Kurdistan and Rojava.
I don't really know his work, but I know of him as an anarchist writer. And,
right. eco-socialist guy. But he refined this to the, well, he was very inspired by ancient Greek democracy. Mm-hmm. And he said, really, the world should be run by neighborhood assemblies.
Mm-hmm.
And so let's do that. And then let's do one in each town.
Yeah.
And then let's connect them.
Right.
And then there were some other sort of variations added to it, including, by the way, interestingly, a pretty strong flavor of feminism.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that seems to be what has been going on in Rojava and is now, I understand, really threatened really by the Turkish military.
Oh, well,
but they made a lot of progress. They've done a lot of amazing things, as well as in other places in Brazil, Argentina, and other places where we pay no attention to what they're doing and can't imagine there'd be anything to learn.
Yeah, anything to learn about that? I don't know.
It sounds
so anyway, communist.
Yeah. It sounds just a little bit like the New England town meeting tradition.
Right. Yes.
That's really, really all we're an expanded version of that.
Yeah. That's all we're talking about.
And then,
it's not complicated, actually.
No.
And then I know that David Byrne has been giving talks called Reasons to Be Cheerful, and he's talking a lot about projects. You mentioned like Rio. Mm-hmm. He's talking about projects that are actually signs of life and signs of hope in like supporting people in the favelas and the poor communities.
That's right.
Well,
I mean, and there's this understanding that favelas are the worst thing that ever happened, you know.
Well, he doesn't, until you tour one, right?
Until you go to one.
Yeah.
Right.
And, you know, you think maybe I could live in a favela if that happened, maybe.
Listen, favelas, some of them in Rio, are now tourist attractions.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Yeah.
They really are great examples of self-organizing communities, some of them. This doesn't mean that they are free from all problems.
Sure.
In particular, as everybody knows, there's some that have terrible drug problems.
Yeah.
But not all, and not all at the same time. They, at the same time, also are artistic havens.
Mm-hmm.
There's local culture. There's local food.
Mm-hmm.
There is a certain esprit, kind of an entrepreneurial fizz about these places, because the city has always just kind of wished they would blow away, has paid them no attention,
just left them.
They pirate their electricity, so when you go through the favela, you take the tour. There's all this incredibly scary looking wire hanging around. You just know we're all about to be electrocuted.
You're living on faith.
Oh my God. But then they're all up on the hillside of Rio looking down at the bay.
Mm-hmm.
So the favelas in Rio all have absolutely $1 million views.
$1 million views.
Yeah, it's it's sort of an inverted scheme where the poor people lived up in the hills and the wealthy lived down low. And usually it's in
the reverse.
Yeah, usually
poor people live in a flood zone.
Yeah, right.
Well, so maybe in terms of happy things to think about, maybe in the coming collapse, whatever it is,
whatever it looks like,
financial, we'll move in this country toward more of an informal economy. Which is a lovely word for feeling like you live in a favela,
right? Well, and I think this is an important point that we almost kind of raised like twice here. The thing that I think a lot of people are frightened of when they talk about any of these things on the anarchy spectrum, where municipalism or self-organizing communities, favelas, etc. They're like, but what about the drugs? You know, what about the problem? What about the crime? What about the, infant mortality? What about, and I think this is a really critical piece here. You need to understand that what this means is that some of the experiments, a lot of the experiments will fail. Some of them horribly. But that's part of this territory. Is that some of the soup projects are not going to go anywhere.
That's right.
It's a great idea and you fund it and it flops. And that's how this works sometimes, is that sometimes the great ideas don't go anywhere.
I was going to say, what about the infant mortality in the wealthiest country in the
world?
So, that's why I was like giggling almost.
So people always have those questions and all these whatabouts. And I think on the one hand, you have to honestly assess reality and that and accept, yes, this that doing things this way means there will be failures. Mm-hmm. Some of the failures will be spectacular. Some of them will be tragic. Yeah. But some of the successes will be repeatable.
Yeah.
No, right. That's yeah.
right. And I think when I say that, I'm not just trying to be glib about the failures and the tragedy. What I'm trying, but the flip side of that is we are not willing to admit that we already have failures and tragedies right. with what that's we're right. doing now.
Right. No,
we have
right.
grotesque inequalities in what we're doing now. We're this already, is, this is, yeah.
This is a little bit like Chuck Marone's small incremental experiments.
Yes.
It's a little bit like that.
A little bit you like know, that.
Chuck, and I bet Chuck would love this. It's also, as I understand it, like Rosa Luxemburg's preference for the honest mistakes of the working class
yes.
over the wisdom of the vanguard party.
Precisely. Absolutely. Because honestly, I think if we assess honestly
yeah.
the tragedies and the failures and the real lack of success in what we do now,
yeah.
if we're honest about it, I think we will see a very difference in the nature and scale of failure when we take little steps and try something new, maybe yep. even something dangerous, yep. and fail. Yep. Right. That it's going to be qualitatively different, and I think quantitatively different as well.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And by yep. when I say yep. different, I don't mean worse, just to be clear, that I think right. taking smaller risks more often
right.
will actually be better.
I wonder, is this a little bit like the way that we believe
mm-hmm.
given the right legal system,
yeah.
we can basically eliminate or certainly manage all risk in society.
Yes, we have
with the result, right? With the result that we have legal anxiety about nearly everything.
Nearly mm-hmm. everything. Mm-hmm. You want to have a potluck in your church basement?
No.
Nope. Well, do you have insurance for that? I'm just wondering, is everyone insured?
You'll poison or electrocute everybody. Yeah.
Right. We're talking about a potluck in your basement of your church.
No, can do.
No, it can't happen. Well, and that sort of space that we've gone into
yeah.
is perverse.
Well, yeah. So that's an informal space. You know, how do you get to legal informality? It just occurred to me. I don't know the answer to that.
No, it's a good question. It's especially in the United States. The state of Michigan has a problem having bringing municipalism here. It's actually a structural problem at the state level. I believe in the late 60s. It may have been as early as like 57. Michigan, which people already think of as kind of like the Wild West for some of our legal structure, revoked something called home rule.
Oh, really?
Yes. So you can't. You are not legally allowed by the state constitution to do things like change your tax structure on a municipal level.
Right. No,
you are not allowed to. Right.
Indiana also.
Right. So there's all these, there's multiple layers of things that a city might do
yes.
that we can't do.
That's right.
It can't happen legally.
We're not alone. I think there's some other states that have this problem too.
Right.
It's like, okay, it's not the feds are getting in the way. It's our damn
state capital.
That's already barred the door.
Right. Has already barred it tight. Shut tight. So, and you think to yourself, well, it's great that, you know, you can't do that as a municipality, except it prevents all kinds of things like local wage ordinances all kinds of things you might approach from a local level. Mm-hmm. Just off the table. It's totally off the table. Mm-hmm. Whereas we have an understanding throughout most of the United States in the back of our heads that, well, you know, all those decisions are going to be at the local level, just like, oh, those federal decisions, we're going to make those at a state level. And that's not true in the state of Michigan. And actually is something I've brought up at just about every meeting I've gone to. It's like, so what about changing the little home rule thing? Just asking. Mm-hmm.
Does anybody even know what you're talking about?
Occasionally they do.
Yeah.
All the Republicans know exactly what I'm talking about. The Democrats look at me like I have two heads.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
That's a noble ambition.
How about this? Yeah. What about that? Can we put that on the table again? Because I think the impetus was a number of municipalities did not want to fluoridate their water.
Oh.
And so the state said, you have to fluoridate your water. You can't make that rule as a municipality. And so
And not only that.
Right. You can't make any of these rules as a municipality. So all those rules became null and void as soon as they instituted revoked home rule.
That is a problem.
So it's a problem. It's a thing. And it's really it's the regulatory thing. And that's where people are like, but what about all the tooth decay? You know, well, what are you going to do then if you revoke home rule?
It's not really any more about the tooth decay.
It just isn't.
Yeah, just flashing back to Dr. Strangelove polluting our precious bodily fluids.
There you go. That's it. Now, so this reminds me a little bit of the comment of a millennial friend of mine, Asif Wilson, who was running a alternative leadership program over in East Chicago. East Chicago is basically, 10 or 20 square blocks of very low-income people stuck in between the BP refinery and U.S. Steel.
Wow.
Okay?
It's a really, the name sounds like it might really be something to do with Chicago. It's really just...
It's a no-man's land.
Probably.
It's all beat up. It's a no-man's
land. I know that.
Cancer cluster, too.
Yeah, I've driven through there on the highway, and I've seen it.
Oh, my God. It's industrial. Yeah. So he gets a grant to come over and take some high school students who are not going to work and they're not going to college. Mm-hmm. And he spends a year giving them Paulo Freire and a bunch of other great stuff, basically about really being social entrepreneurs.
Mm-hmm.
Very wonderful, talented, young African-American guy, just got a PhD in education and has gone off to teach somewhere, I guess. Yeah. But I was talking to him about, organizing and stuff like that. And I said, well, it's not exactly like the old days where you get a bunch of people and you go down to City Hall and you bang on the door and you ask for the seat at the table. Yeah. And Asif broke into this big smile and he said, no, man. He said, we're not doing that anymore. And I said, really? What are you going to do? He said, well, we're going to go to the other end of the town and we're going to build our own damn table.
Good move.
I thought, wow, that is exactly what is going on in Detroit. Mm-hmm. That's what needs to go on in Gary.
Yeah.
And that is what municipalism amounts to,
Right.
Sort of alternative structures.
And it would not surprise me that if there are these swaths of Detroit where they're shutting off the lights and the kind of just kind of abandoned parts of the city, which I think for the city as a whole is probably a good idea, to be honest.
Right.
That Detroit has always been too large and too flat.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that's needed to happen. It never should have happened the way it did.
That's right.
But I would not be shocked or amazed to see people come to the fore and create new municipal structures in those spaces.
True.
Right? Sort of true. Like an inner ring suburb.
Yeah.
Would be birthed in that space.
Yeah.
I could see that happening in a couple of places where there's a really strong civic presence and these folks just don't want to leave.
Well, but the problem being that a lot of them are probably near to brownfields, as far as what's in the soil.
Yeah, which is an ongoing thing in every part of every city.
Yeah.
That's just an ongoing reality that we really can't look away from. And on the one hand, we can't look away from it. But on the other hand, we have to figure out how to live with it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Live with it, live alongside it. We can't just abandon. Because all these cities, every American city, is in the best place possible. It's in the best geographic location possible.
Just because that's where it was built there for a reason.
It was built there for a reason. Historically.
Yeah. Yeah.
And
yeah.
that reality has not changed.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Right?
Mm-hmm. Right?
I mean, until, I don't know, California falls into the ocean.
Exposing some new waterfront. Sea routes,
until there's some kind of cataclysmic physical change to the geography, that's just reality.
Right.
And so we have to figure out how to live with these places.
It's still about who has access to water, shipping,
et cetera, and the roads, and et cetera, all those things.
Yep.
And that's not going to change, which is why it's been so important for these municipalities as they sort of like move through their decay process to wait out the hanger-ons who are poor.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Because, how should I say? That's the best land. You're just waiting for it to become open.
Oh. The location is intrinsically valuable. It
has intrinsic value. Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So that'll be interesting to see how that shakes. And I think Detroit and the people in it have, the people who, especially the people who have stayed, have what it takes to build new tables and, you know, start again.
Yes. Yes.
And just start, you know, with something new where they are. Yeah. So that'll be interesting to watch unfold. And it's one of the things I kind of expect to happen, you know, as like what we were talking in last week's podcast about how Detroit and Michigan are this needle the entire United States has to pass through, where we have to figure it out. Yep. How are we going to use these huge industrial cities? How are we going to live with them? How are we going to live in them?
And the populations that are there.
That are there.
Already.
How are we going to do it?
Not everyone can move to Austin and become a software engineer.
No, that can't happen. And also, what are we going to do about losing... I was talking with someone else. I was talking with Joy today about losing the brain drain that happens where... Yeah. You know, all the so-called best and brightest leave the community. Yep. How do you function then? How do you? And really, the truth is, they have to come back.
Right.
Right. Because if you think about it, like, you know, like some of these towns, these sort of rural towns, or even like sort of off the path cities like Saginaw. So you take the entire graduating class from your public high school, you take the entire graduating class from your private high school, and the top 10%, the kids with the most charisma, the most talent, and the most sort of gifts, they are also the same 10% that the community has invested the most in.
That's right. That's right.
Literally, the blood, sweat, and tears of the community are in those children. And they pack up and they leave and they never come back.
The meritocrats.
Yes. So every year, it's another dramatic loss of the community's most cherished investment.
No, right, right.
So I think the only rational answer is to stop sending that investment away.
Yes.
Like literally just giving it to New York and San Francisco and Austin.
From Michigan, it was Chicago.
It was Chicago.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
we got to create desirable places in some
Precisely. It has to be a place you want to stay. It has to be a place that's worth staying.
I was just talking to Paul about this because, you know, in Indiana, I've got a friend, a guy that just retired from Indiana University, Bloomington, where he was an economic historian. And one of his specialties was the state of Indiana itself, actually. And he's very intimately aware of all this data around economic development and all the different communities around the state. And as I was talking to him about my various little schemes, he said, you know, we need to figure out what is the population number below which you are not coming back.
That there, it's like the point of no return.
The community's not coming back, or people aren't coming back.
Do what you want. Have all
the
sleeps you want.
Can't function.
Oh, right.
Have all the neighborhood parties. There's no neighborhood. It's all gone.
It's gone.
You do not have what it takes. You're just going to have to let go. You know,
right. There's some threshold number, right?
There's got to be. And I think we could almost imagine what the number is. It's probably, I'm thinking maybe around 10,000, 15,000. I don't know how below that you can do it.
For a city? And
Yeah.
I'm not sure if it's a number per se as much as it is a density level.
Right.
It could be a density level.
Because I was thinking that number for a neighborhood is 300 individuals.
For a neighborhood.
For a neighborhood.
Yeah.
Could be. It seems I was just saying to Paul.
Oh, sorry. This is part of the problem with Saginaw is that the way it's collapsed is that it's now just a scattered enclaves, and the downtown does exist, but it's all missing teeth. And a lot of the neighborhoods that have emptied out are now filled with decaying, abandoned houses.
And so there's still people, but not
Yeah, there's not still critical mass. People living there, but now there's like all the spaces in between them are empty.
That also describes Gary, Indiana.
Same
thing.
Same thing.
Very difficult with no density.
Exactly.
Because
there's 50,000 people there.
Right.
But
They don't get to know their neighbors.
They don't have any functional interaction with each other. Now, what was it you were telling Paul earlier?
Oh, about I thought there was. I came up with this idea. That there's probably maybe three ingredients. And if you are missing one, you're probably not going to make it.
Right.
So one is, I think, your town probably needs to have some bones. It needs to look like something. And there are actually towns around me here in Northwest Indiana that really do not have a downtown.
It's not a place.
So what is this thing? You know?
Some of those towns I saw, like going through Virginia and places like that, where there is an old downtown.
That's right.
It's where it's where the Civil War monument is.
And you drive through and you think, could we have this? You know?
Yeah, but it's not functioning as a downtown anymore. Nope. There's some kind of a civic thing, a municipal building a couple miles away.
Right.
Yeah. Well, so the second ingredient is some kind of economic activity. Something has to be going on.
Right? Yeah.
And then the third thing, I think, is there needs to be some history of local families and others being civically involved.
Right.
And so if you're missing one of those three, I just don't know how you're going to do it.
Yeah.
It seems like the economic element, too, a lot of these towns, there is some economic activity going on, but what is going on are only the businesses that are feeding off the last remnant of the money of the people who are stranded there. The diabetes centers, the infusion, what do they call that?
Those infusion centers.
Yeah.
Dialysis
centers.
Yeah.
And because the people who are stranded there are retired, many of them are still collecting Social Security and pension. and they get Medicaid. Right. And so there are businesses that can support themselves on their Medicaid money.
Yep.
But but that's unless that town is also growing,
that's not sustainable.
There's a horizon, you know.
Now here's my question, and how I think just about every distributist that I know is the question I have that brought me in contact with them. I'm still asking this question. Are we talking about GM as the economic activity? Mm. And I'm using GM as a stand-in.
Sure.
Are we talking about a large singular industrial employer? Are we talking about...
Everyone gets an Amazon warehouse.
Or are we talking about a particular industry? Is like our town's a tourist town. This is what we do.
Yeah.
Are we talking about... or are we talking about an economy, a local economy that serves the needs of the people that live there for all their needs?
Very good question. Yeah,
because that's the question that I think really breaks the bank right there. Because if we're talking about GM Jesus, that's not going to work. Mm-hmm. It works for GM.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, mm-hmm. Saginaw's history is a boom and bust cycle, right? Before it was GM, it was the lumber industry.
It was the industry. Was the lumber industry. When the trees were gone, the industry left.
Yep.
And before that, it was beans.
Yep.
And after they stripped the soil, well, I think I may have reversed that. I think it was lumber, and then the trees were gone, so they planted beans. And then the soil was, deplenished.
Yeah, but it was basically a monoculture.
A monoculture of industry.
Yeah.
Like where there's a big we see the t-shirts for Saginaw, they've got a bunny on them.
Yeah.
For the bunny beans.
Elevator,
a bean elevator, like a grain elevator, but for beans.
Right.
And at one point world's history, I think 80% of all the beans on the planet came through Saginaw, Michigan. Like some crazy, like
there's
absurd
factoid.
That, you know, it was not just all beans, but like Great Northern beans.
Yeah.
They were supplying armies, right? Like all their, Navy beans came from Saginaw, Michigan.
And so, young Theodore Rethke was standing there watching those beans.
Watching his beans go. he spent most of his time watching the greenhouses. Yeah, that was the other thing. There were all these greenhouses to produce flowers, vegetables, etc. year round for the city.
Yeah.
Those are gone now. So you think to yourself, how did Saginaw eat through the winter? In 1900, greenhouses.
Huh.
Because, like I said, it's the it's the coldest, northernmost, like large, reasonably sized city in Michigan. Past that, it's like there are towns like Cadillac and places like that,
Marquette,
but they're considerably smaller.
Considerably smaller.
Yeah.
Like half, a quarter of the size. And so, what you end up with? So if it's an industry, you know that industry can collapse.
Mm-hmm.
If it's a specific employer, when things aren't going their way,
the market conditions
change, they will leave.
They lose their tax incentives. That's a big one.
They go. And I think the only one of those economic engines or activity things is if you have an economy serving the needs of the people there, feeding them, housing them, clothing them, etc. And so absent that, you're looking at this very fragile economic situation.
Yep, sure. Yep. Just more neoliberal extraction.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that's really the thing. It is literally just extraction.
Yeah.
GM came and extracted labor.
Yep.
After we'd extracted the lumber, after we'd extracted the soil health, and so on.
Part of the reason we are still burdened with the house, the old house, besides, you know, the economic conditions selling a house is the result of a couple other industries that didn't pay their fair share of the wreckage
asbestos
and lead. Right.
Oh my God.
So lead paint and asbestos insulation.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. They're all, you know, people made bank on it for decades and then were like, oh, that's actually not safe.
And they were legally protected.
Legally enjoined from having to, you know,
and then 45 minutes away, the employer that I had for a while, Dow Chemical, is still fighting a legal battle to avoid actually starting the process of cleaning up the whole river.
Yeah. Which is pristine north of the Dow.
Yeah.
Plant. Huh. I mean, it's some of the best water in the state, north of the Dow plant. South of it, you can't eat the fish.
Jeez.
I mean, people do.
Mm-hmm. So when we bought the house, we got all this paperwork about how the whole area was contaminated with dioxin. So.
From that, yeah. Yeah, those are the specifics in Saginaw. I'm sure Gary has a story.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Detroit has lots of stories.
No, it's just this was played out. Like you said, extraction and then exploitation and failure of the industries to actually clean up the damage.
Any of the damage. Right. And so it's twofold. On the one hand, it's fragile. It's not a good idea for your local economy. Mm-hmm. And on the other hand...
To have a single employer.
To have a single employer or a single industry.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right? And on the other hand... So now on the one hand, it's economically fragile. It's just a bad idea. Right? And I think any of us, you know, kind of looking at the numbers can just see that plain as day. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, it's also sort of like I want to say immoral, you know, to do this kind of extraction and destruction of a place.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. Right? So it's twofold. It's not just a poor economic equation. It's not just immoral. It's all these things at once. And no wonder all these cities look this way.
No, right. Economic strip mining.
Just stripping away at every turn. I mean, what else would you expect the city to look like after that's done?
You know, a friend of mine is about, I think, to run for mayor in Valparaiso.
Awesome.
He is also a big Strong Towns fan.
Amen.
So he wrote up his first position paper. He's still kind of queasy about doing this. frankly, these days, to run for public office probably would make anyone queasy. But he came right out and he said, you know, we're all excited about a proposed $75 million transportation district, transportation-oriented district project. I don't even think the damn thing ought to be built. And he sort of goes into a Strong Towns song and dance.
Nice.
And I want to...
yeah.
I'm going to have a coffee with him tomorrow, and I'm kind of an informal advisor. Mm-hmm. But I want to say, you know, Bill, I don't think he can say this.
I'm not...
Well, Chuck...
I just don't think this is... I mean, I think this is right, of course.
Yeah.
But I think you're going to have to talk about something else. You're going to have to do what Pete Buttigieg did in South Bend and just talk about innovation all the time. You know,
That's the
only thing to talk about. Because everybody thinks that sounds great, you know, whatever that is.
Now, Chuck learned that actually criticizing his own, a profession had consequences.
Yeah. Oh, no, not
had real consequences.
Yeah.
Real consequences. You get in trouble. The problem is,
you know, this economic development debate, you know, people think of it as two different things. The thing we've been doing, particularly at the local level, where it really does not work, and that is called economic hunting.
Yes.
And you go out and you try to bag some big game, right?
Yeah.
And when they move here, they're going to hire us all, and everything
it's going to be great, right?
And we spend a lot of money doing this, and then it doesn't happen, you know? Or they jilt us. They jilt us, and then they move away,
right?
But the alternative, which we don't seem to get, is economic gardening.
No.
And we're learning about this because nice. We just had a big employer here in Valparaiso that had been around for decades mm-hmm. and put a ton of money into the city. And they said one morning, you know, we've decided we're going to move just across the county line.
Oops. Better for business.
And everybody, oh my God, you're going to do what? You know?
Yeah.
So what we should have been doing was spending money convincing them, no, you need to stay exactly where you are because it's just going to get better. And mm-hmm. not only this one, you know, big employer, but all the other small to medium-sized businesses where we should have been gardening and keeping these people around, you know, for the
long haul,
social texture, you know?
Right.
Well, and people don't get that. They don't
get that at all.
Well, with the tax break situation, if you've given away everything you've got to give, you're starting out in a pretty bad negotiating position. Yeah. You're just coming to Amazon or whoever is a beggar. And then when they're like, hey, how about a little something down the road to keep, you know, this is a nice little local economy you've got going here. It'd be a shame if something were to happen to it. You've got nothing.
You have no bargaining chips at all.
You've got no chips. Well,
and I think part of that frame of economic gardening is this idea that some of these are not going to make it.
Yeah.
Some of your plants are going to, you know, they're not going to make it.
Right.
And, you know, it's okay.
Well, in the Strong Towns blog, and I know in Chuck's talks, he used to talk about, like, how about instead of, you know, spending $75 million on this civic development project, we spend, you know, $7,500 a hundred times or something, or 75, you know, like
right, and 1,000 times,
and then many of those, like even things like bike lanes and parking spaces and flowers and, you know,
whatever,
these simple little things that change the way people perceive streetscape was a huge win. It cost it was a pittance.
It was a pittance by comparison. Right.
And so even if, you know, if 90 of those projects fail, you've still spent less.
You spent far less. And you've got 10 successes instead of one.
Right. Yeah. And these huge economic redevelopment.
Right. And I think there's a friend of mine online is now championing how things are better now than they ever have been. Mm-hmm. That sort of space. It feels like a economic libertarian frame. Because, you know, our GDP is so high and, you know, infant mortality is so low and on and on, right?
Yep.
And
those numbers are all moving in the wrong direction. And you can't, GDP doesn't mean anything. But
it's just, you know, it's fairy tale. But that's the frame people are using when they talk about success.
Right.
And I think part of it is, he describes it as ideological. Part of it is philosophical, because I don't think raising the GDP by treating cancer 10 times
is better. It's a win.
I don't think that's a win.
Right.
I think lowering the GDP and not having anyone with cancer, that would be a win.
No, I mean, defense contractors are huge economic boons. If you take out all the externalities.
Yeah. Right? So those are the questions you've got. I mean, and you can engage this argument, and if you get lost in the weeds of the numbers, or how many more people are dying or fewer, how many more infants survive childhood, and so on. You can get lost in those weeds, but the real conversation is about the philosophy underpinning the definition of success. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of us have an intuitive understanding of success, and we see it when we drive through a functioning city.
Yeah, right.
And we know it when we're looking at it.
Yes.
That's right.
Right? And then, and we know it when we don't see it, that maybe the city kind of is dying or has passed.
Yeah.
Right,
yep.
But none of us can articulate the philosophy that would put the numbers to it, where you can turn it into an index.
Yeah,
And to some extent, I feel like that's almost a folly to try and turn that into an index, when it's very much this thing that you know it when you see it.
Well, you know, from Christopher Alexander, the guy who wrote about architecture and design patterns.
Yes.
I'll like to talk about the quality without a name, right? Mm-hmm. And it's everywhere in classic buildings and our most beloved parks and public spaces and monuments and whatnot. But it's very difficult. I mean, he spends a lot of pages trying to articulate what it is.
And I think I appreciate his work doing that.
Yes.
But to some degree, it's really folly.
Yeah.
Because human beings know it when they see it.
They do. Then that's sort of almost his definition.
Right.
Interesting. Yeah. You know, a friend of mine here in town, our town, keep in mind, is just a little over 30,000 people. He's a real committed progressive. Mm-hmm. And he's very angry at the town fathers because he believes that there is some sort of ideological, almost conspiracy about doing things the wrong way. And I occasionally try to make the point to him that it is very much not about ideology in our town, really, not in any conscious way. It is a whole lot about people going to high school together.
Yes.
Okay.
Huh.
Yes.
At our level, at our scale of 30,000 people, I think that is most of it. It's got to do with familiarity.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Because I don't think any of these people spend any time worrying about ideology and would not have any idea what in the world you're talking about.
What even ideology they're talking about.
Correct. Right. Now, having said that, I want to add that the other little project for, Solidarity Hall, c'est moi, is I have gotten a press pass for next week to attend the Socialism 2018 conference in Chicago.
Well, all right then.
Oh, cool.
So how do you like them apples?
I'd like to be there.
I'd like to be there.
Yeah.
I think it's going to be really a fascinating scene. I have a very strongly sympathetic twinge, as you can imagine.
Mm-hmm.
I'm looking at the program and I'm struck by the fact of how much of it is really sort of educational, historical. It reminds me of kind of the old days when there were teach-ins on campus.
Yeah.
And the young grad student would go out and begin by explaining what colonialism was in Vietnam.
Right. Let's just get some of the basics straight, guys. Yeah.
Okay? Right. Right. Here's where this all came from. You know, same thing. This is a bunch of millennials, a lot of them.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're going to, you know, the history of the Haymarket riots and, you know.
And so on. Right.
And so on and so on and so on and so on. What I really am interested in, this is 4 days, by the way, 4 days.
Oh, man.
And there's a ton of identity stuff, which, some of which I'm sure will be very good.
Mm-hmm.
And some interesting writers will be there. Nobody super famous. But what I'm really looking for, I don't know if it's going to be there, is much in the way of discussion of economic root causes. So I'm sure neoliberalism will come up very frequently, but will there be really much analysis
or
much you can put your teeth into, or is it going to stay kind of on the surface and kind of issue oriented rather than trying to drill a little deeper?
Right.
I don't know. So
we'll see. Now, we're going to have you back on now.
Yeah, we need a follow-up follow-up report.
Yeah.
Okay. What I saw at the socialism conference.
Yay! Yeah. What I do with my summer.
We have such a huge reading list, piles of books on our...
Yeah,
So one of the... You mentioned identity issues, and one of the books we've got is Asa Hayder's book on identity politics.
Right.
It's called Mistaken Identity.
Mistaken Identity.
And it's a short book, and I have only read the first chapter, but I found it pretty fascinating.
I think it's worth it. I've only kind of scratched the surface too.
We've got to dive into that. And then we're last couple shows ago we were talking with our friend Chris about this Melinda Cooper's book on the history of the family and how American policy was tailored to define and aid and harm families.
Families, right. The sort of nuclear family.
I see.
Subset.
But we really want to talk about the identity book because Grace describes it as, you know, she's not opposed to identity politics. She's opposed to the cynical abuse of identity politics.
And
which is all I kind of see.
So much of it that I see, especially from the stemming from the 2016 election, which we're still litigating at every turn, is that cynical identity, cynical misuse of identity.
I see another hopeful sign. Mm-hmm. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez.
We're very excited about that.
Yeah, I was glad to see it. It's a good new direction.
Absolutely. Not only is she something that nobody practically ever heard of, a democratic socialist.
Right.
Did you notice she's a practicing Catholic?
I did.
How about it?
Yeah. I'm all over it. It's all right. Yeah. That's all right.
I am so hopeful that she, given the pull of the media and the way, you know, she's a darling. She's already a darling.
Right.
And she's going to become even more darling. I think she can step up to that. Right. She's going to become some kind of media-driven counterfoil to, as I refer to him, the incumbent.
The incumbent. I think so.
I am excited by this prospect that millennials seem to be embracing the DSA.
And
I'm not exactly entire. Don't feel like I'm entirely congruent with everything the DSA does, but they're a broad. Yeah. You know, they work for broad goals. You know,
and
try
frankly,
to be a big tent. There's a lot they do that I really appreciate.
Right. I'm a little bit chastened by the fact that I think it's great that she won a primary in a strong district that will likely elect her as senator to Congress. Mm-hmm. I would like to have seen six more going to Congress this fall.
Yeah,
that's what I would really like to see in November, is say like six or seven or eight of her in Congress. And then I think we can open up a new space in our political conversation.
You know what? I did see three or four.
Yeah.
I did see three or four.
It is,
there was an article that listed... and I think they're all women. I believe they're practically all women. So that was good. What I really think is going to be curious for me about the conference is the fact that in a lot of ways, I get the sense that practically nobody really knows what this word socialism means anymore.
No, it's just a boogaboo.
Yeah.
Right.
Like, socialism. It's under your bed.
Or a banner.
People spent so many years red baiting that they never even bothered to learn anything about that history.
Right.
There's that group. And then there's the younger group that says, yes, we love this word. Actually, we're not really very clear on what's supposed to happen.
But it's a good word. It's different than what we're doing. Well, basically, it's different than what we're doing.
That's right. That's the key thing. That's the key thing. Well, so the beauty of that is, I mean, the disadvantage is, as you know, nobody knows where anything came from, so we don't have much cultural historical memory, except among a few people and a few older types, as to what the word really means. But on the plus side, that may mean we're free to reinvent it.
I think so.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's great, which is nice.
Because if you think about terms and phrases like conservative and pro-life, and these words are really having a funeral right now.
They really are.
Yeah.
It's sad, actually.
It is sad.
Yeah.
Maybe that's a good thing.
I
just realized this is kind of weird. Today, I was going through my library, which is not really humongous. It's not on the pot scale, let's put it that way. but I was going through, and I realized once in a while, I don't know how many times in a lifetime, you say, you know, I don't believe this anymore.
Yeah, you're like,
this isn't me anymore. I remember when I bought this. I remember what I was thinking. No, I don't think this anymore. I don't need this.
We are, to put it in perspective, we are woefully overdue to do a big purge of the POTS library.
You know, that would be a fun thing. We should advertise it on the POTS cast. We should do it on the front lawn. We should do that this fall.
Well, I keep saying as we get rid of books, we should offer them to people.
Oh, that's true. Yeah. That could be nice, too. We could also just give it away. That's true.
Yeah.
And really, on our front line, we would just be giving it away. Just come and get a book.
Yeah.
Or 10.
Yeah.
And then there'll be like little kits. I'm also going to prepare kits of books to hand out to every passersby, you know. Like, you need to read this. Just promise me you'll read it and you can have it. Those books are good.
You guys, because of your interest in popular culture, you guys have some stuff that would be definitely valuable to anybody that had been paying any attention. Without any doubt, you'll have stuff that is so esoteric that nothing other than the occasional poli-sci PhD.
Grace's some of Grace's stuff is pretty esoteric.
Pretty esoteric, yeah.
But we're trying to make it. What we're trying to do is make it less esoteric.
A little less esoteric, just a little bit less. I think it's good to have a focus, but yeah, you know.
But your interests change, you know, your outlook changes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And when you're a really old guy like me, you've gone through a number of different mental revolutions.
Yeah.
And if you're still hauling around some of those books, you're thinking, oh my God,
what am I even doing? Yeah.
It's funny how much I'm 50 and how much I'm now basically enjoying a lot of classics more than I ever did when I tried to read them when I was younger.
Yeah.
And not even, they don't even all have to be old classics, you know, like, yes, I did read the kids' Moby Dick.
That was good.
Or part of it.
Part of it, yeah. They weren't ready for the whole thing.
Even better than advertised, huh?
See?
Yeah. And that's a book I love and I've read several times. But even things like, I'm deep into the New York Review Books classics.
Oh, yeah.
They publish a lot of stuff that's, it's not all stellar, but it's stuff that's disappeared. Vanished from print, and they're bringing stuff back into print. And I find amazingly, intriguingly weird books like Hadrian the VII, you know, the man that became Pope accidentally.
Oops. He's the Pope.
Just fantastic imaginative stories.
Right.
But these days I'm also reading a whole lot of books that are part of the Penguin Deluxe Illustrated Classics. They're trade paperbacks.
But they're beautiful to hold and to see.
Honestly, that's a good chunk of why I pick them up is that they have great illustrations. They're often very sardonic about the content. The illustrations are closely related to the content, but it's in a way where it interprets it or criticizes it in some way.
Right.
It's very funny. And so we read a bunch of those.
Was Moby Dick one of those editions?
Yeah.
I thought you mentioned that. Okay.
Yeah.
And there's one other thing. I don't know if you guys have this experience. I was trying to describe it to my daughters. Mm-hmm. And I was saying to them, I have two in college. And I said, you know, let me tell you why you're there. your job, now write this down. Your job is to find the teachers that are really spectacular, really thoughtful. And I don't mean entertaining. I mean, there's going to be a few people, and you got to figure out where they are. It really doesn't matter too much what they're teaching.
No.
You just got to find them and hang out with them and figure out what are they about. Mm-hmm. And then I said, you know, you may adopt some of their ideas and maybe even their worldview. Mm-hmm. And I said, you know, I was fortunate enough to have a few of these. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to tell you a strange thing. And that is in many ways, I no longer really believe or agree with a lot of what they were teaching me in some cases. It has taken me years to work through that.
to go beyond what they actually shared with you.
Yeah.
To the point where you could look, put it in context.
That's right. And in some ways, I still have enthusiasm for many aspects of it. And at the same time, I can stand back and say, well, but I do not at all believe X, Y, or C. You know? So, but that process is a very important, engrossing intellectual exercise. And if you do that, you're going to love college. You're going to love what it's going to do for you.
Right.
So try to get to that as soon as you can. You
get to that space. Right.
The big thing that I got was this, really thinking back, it was being in a very privileged position, honestly, of basically having all my material needs met for long enough that I really could just, like, I could pick and choose to some extent, you know.
Yeah.
I did have to get my major and try to finish in 4 years. But, like, I took classes in the medieval mystery plays. Mm-hmm. I took, you know, and I would show up and it would be a seminar class with six students, you know, we're studying the Wakefield Second Shepherd's play and medieval literature just absolutely fascinated me, you know, and not everyone even in this rarefied small group was there honestly really into it. Mm-hmm. But the ones that were made it worthwhile. I audited a seminar on Joyce's Ulysses. One of the, I wasn't even taking the class for credit. I missed a lot of them, but the teacher knew me because I had been in some of her classes before.
Right.
And a couple times she opened up the floor and said, why don't you give this lecture?
Right.
Really?
And I did it.
Wow. You know, spectacular. That's great. That's great.
That was a wonderful experience.
A wonderful experience.
Yeah. And, you know, all some of the computer science projects too, maybe not as relatable to most people, but, you know, where we'd have team projects and some big challenging projects, and I'd go, we just like work round the clock, do these heroic achievements, which, you know, to talk to people now who are in computer science and they've never done systems as difficult, as challenging as those were. So.
Yeah.
Right. This is the kind of theme that our friend Michael Martin writes and talks about, you know.
Yeah.
But I can remember there's a point where finally I sort of caught fire a little bit in the way that you're just describing. Mm-hmm. And I practically reached the point where I couldn't wait to wake up in the morning and get back at it, you know.
Uh-huh. Right. Yeah.
It's so exciting. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, it's, and I think tasting that energy once carries you for a long
time. It does.
It really does.
I taught a class at Saginaw Valley State University. They were, you know, clearly scraping the bottom of the barrel to hire me as an adjunct. But no, they couldn't find qualified people in the region to teach system software. Mm-hmm. They were short. They didn't have enough instructors. So I did this thing as an adunct. And it was a real different experience and frustrating in many ways because I was really trying to challenge the students, and a handful of them did well. But a number of them, I would get to this point where you could see they were like almost getting it and they were wrestling with some kind of difficult ideas in computer science. And they'd come to office hours or come to meet me at the library. And they looked always so panicked. And
yes.
And what I was trying to convey to them, and that I couldn't convey to them, because our experiences in school were so divergent now, is that feeling of like, I've almost got it, it's frustrating me. You should live in that feeling.
That's the spot you're going for.
You should embrace that feeling. That's your clue to push on through.
To keep pushing. Right.
But because their circumstances were different, maybe they were getting too far into debt. There's more riding on it. There's more, there's just more personal like urgency to them getting through this. Mm-hmm. And they could not accept like the sense of risk that they wouldn't get it.
They wouldn't get it. Right.
And it just terrified them. And I felt so bad because I was trying to help them have this experience that was like the best that came out of my education.
Right.
But I get the feeling now that by not just sort of signing everyone an A, you know, I was really just tormenting many of them.
Right. That's not how the game is played anymore.
Their lives just didn't give them the space that we all had at one point.
Yeah.
Right.
But
to,
I do
to
know,
accommodate that.
I do know that I actually conveyed the material because a handful of students did run with it, you know.
Yeah, right.
And had a good time, you know.
Yeah.
But there was this sort of middle group of students that were in pain, you know.
They're really struggling and not in a good way.
Yeah, and that's what like higher education seems to me now is largely so many people just like it's the new high school, and it's like this is your bare minimum hurdle you have to clear.
Painful.
And you have to borrow $100,000 to do it.
Or even just 25.
Or even just, well, yeah, the number, you know.
The number can be
proportional
different.
Proportional to your income or what, and your eventual income, but it can still be ridiculous.
Or just a ridiculous number.
A ridiculous burden.
Yeah. Right.
But,
so
yeah, I don't know.
It's hard. This was my take on the college experience. There's like the what we like it to be for.
Yeah.
What we think it should be for.
Yeah.
And like what it is actually for. Like what it's designed for.
Uh-huh.
And my big takeaway was that college was about finding those connections and networks that will then sort of take you the other places you're going to go.
Yeah, Grace explained to me why, it was years and years after I graduated, she explained to me what was actually going on with all those social events and trips and
stuff.
Events and things like that, and even the sports.
Yeah.
She's like, let me explain this. Here, I'll take you. So here's why that all was happening.
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh, it wasn't really for me, was it? The kid from the trailer park who didn't know anyone.
It's not for you.
Yeah.
It's precisely what you were talking about a few minutes ago, where it's not about your ideology. It's about who you went to high school with. It's not about ideology. Whatever booger bear you want to put in the blank.
Yeah.
It's about who you went to college with, who your parents knew, who your friends know and like.
And who can give you a hookup in later life or connection.
And just sort of this kind of, and I don't mean to suggest, imply, or even say that that's wrong. I just mean to point out that that's what's happening.
And it's dishonest to pretend that it's something entirely different.
Right.
No, right.
That really, you're forming networks that are going to last you for the rest of your life.
Yeah.
And that's what's happening.
And
I gotta admit, having two in college right now is a real mental exercise for me and just trying to figure out what on earth are they doing? How are we going to get through this? And how can I buffer what's going on there so that they, I will say my oldest, she worked for a nearby bakery, a bakery restaurant the summer before her freshman year. Her conclusion from that was that she should sign up for the business school.
Oh my.
So about halfway through, she called me up.
Oh dear.
You know, someone, you know, caught in a jail or something. And she said, I have got to get out of this place.
What's the phrase?
What do you mean?
Oh, my poor, sweet summer child.
So what does she mean?
What were we expecting? She said, well, I don't know. She said, I just looked around and I realized there are two kinds of people in this building. And I said, yeah. And she said, half of them want to work for Procter & Gamble and the other half are jocks.
I'm in the wrong place, Dad.
I'm in the wrong place.
I got to get out of here.
She crossed the street and went over to, in Bloomington, it's the school that Eleanor Ostrom taught in. It's called SPIA. Something about social sciences, and I forget what else the acronym stands for. So she signed up for environmental policy and has felt much better ever
since.
Much
more at home.
Yeah.
No, that's an interesting conversation to have. It's a worthwhile conversation.
Got that out of the way.
There's.
But I'm sort of struggling with them, in other words, just to
Wrestle through it.
You know, and to help them understand what their mentors are for. And, you know, mentors have a little bit of self-interest. So
you got to
balance all these things. You know, it's tricky.
It's tricky.
I'm trying to remember what publication it was that I read this in recently. It might have been the New Yorker, I don't know. It's an article about how all these universities that teach economics actually have two economics departments. And one of them is the vaunted, you know, Chicago School of Economics or what, you know, that follows whatever Austrian teaching and, you know, that really teaches the economics from the ground up, theory and, you know, all this. And the other is attached to the business school.
That's right.
Yes.
That teaches them a little bit about actual practical economics and how it works in the real world.
And they're two separate spaces.
Yeah, really separate.
They're not actually overlapping in any meaningful
way. No, that's true.
Yeah.
But it really, I think, lays bare this reality of how very local all politics are. That it all comes back to like who you're sitting next to.
Yeah.
Right.
Important nexuses in our life.
This is true.
Yeah.
Let me ask you, we have time for me to shift gears for one more Solidarity Hall matter.
Please.
One
more. Here's what it is. I woke up a few weeks ago thinking about, maybe because of my conversations with our friend Paul Grinier and his new project, the Simone Weil Center for Political Philosophy.
Oh, yeah.
Which our friend Susanna Black is also involved in. Mm-hmm. Well, so I was thinking about the fact that I wish I knew Russian. And I then remembered, of course, that many years ago, and when I say many, let me just specify 40.
40
wow.
years ago.
Okay.
Just yeah. out of grad school, I decided what I needed to do was learn a hard foreign language
right.
for which I could get paid for knowing it.
Exactly.
And I thought about Chinese. I thought about various things. But I was reading some Russian literature, and I thought, no, what I need to do, I need to sign up for a trip to the Soviet Union.
Wow.
I need to spend
yeah.
the whole summer camping in the Soviet Union and just do a crash program. And I'll come back, you know, with a much better Russian or a little bit of Russian. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure it'll be a life-changing event. You know, what
yeah.
the hell, to go to Russia for 3 months? It's got to change your whole head, you know?
Yeah.
So I did that. And I went. I was not terribly political. I was, you know, rather skeptical, of course, about the USSR. Mm-hmm. This was 1978. It was the summer wow. yeah. of the three popes.
Oh.
So Paul VI died.
Right.
John Paul I was installed for a month.
Right.
And then
had
oh,
a heart
yeah.
attack or some yeah. weird thing, died. And then in August, this Polish guy.
Some weirdo. comes in, this weirdo.
As we're in the Soviet Union, and a friend of mine on the trip, who happened to be a scholar of Eastern Europe, mm-hmm. told me the news, and he said, "You understand, he's a Pole." He said, "This is an earthquake."
Wow.
It's huge.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. 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 And I didn't quite, you know, get what he meant. Okay. Anyway, mm-hmm. so we had this amazing trip. And so I made notes. Mm-hmm. I did not have a camera, but I got copies of photographs from a friend on the trip who took quite a few. And I kept my journal. And I really did nothing much with the trip. I didn't really write it up in any way.
Right.
But now it's many, many years later. And as I was reading some of Paul's stuff and thinking about where Russia is today, I thought, you know, I should do a little short travel book. Mm-hmm. And I will call it a travel memoir. And in it, I am going to sort of rethink the Cold War.
Mm. Oh, wow.
Because mm-hmm. I really had not much of an idea what it was at the time, except in a very sort of distorted mirror.
Right.
And, mm-hmm. and so much has changed, and the country's changed, and the world has changed. So I'm doing my first book, really, and I've written about two chapters of it, called In a Russian Mirror. Mm-hmm. And what I'm doing is using the Russian trip to talk about American empire.
Oh.
Hmm.
This is going to be playing, worthwhile.
Yeah.
One off, well, thank
that
you,
sounds
thank
cool.
You.
Yeah.
Playing one off the other. And it's very anecdotal, because otherwise it wouldn't be readable, you know.
Right, right.
So I'm trying not to pontificate too much. But I am really staggered by how much I did not see. But I do realize now that the guy who organized the trip, whom I met either very briefly or not at all, I don't remember. He was a Russian Jewish guy teaching at MIT, teaching Russian. Mm-hmm. He was a wonderful kind of wild man who wrote a notorious Russian textbook, which reads like a Marx Brothers script.
Wow.
And is really famous
yeah.
for just these weird non sequitur conversations he wrote mm-hmm. up. He explained that this was a trip that was going to be maximally unrestricted. And what he meant was, if we do enough camping, you can go out and meet regular Russians. You know,
right.
you can
oh,
get,
nice.
You can get
without the minders and
right. without the minders, right?
Yeah. Right.
You won't be in the official hotels
yeah.
and you will have some official guides around, but you'll get up close and involved with the ordinary Russian, which after the trip I realized was a great thing.
Mm-hmm.
Because that is the way ideology breaks down.
Right.
You know, when you're yeah. there experiencing it and seeing it and living and talking to these people, it's a wonderful thing. It's really a wonderful, wonderful thing.
Yeah.
So I thought of this when Paul was talking about his trip to St. Petersburg a few weeks ago, and he went to the symphony and he was listening to a Soviet composer, and how he was saying how wonderful the music was and how ashamed he was that he never paid attention to this guy, because he was, after all, as Paul used to think of him, a Soviet composer.
Hmm.
Right.
So somehow less worthy
less worthy of attention. Yeah. Right.
Yeah. But he was wonderful, just wonderful. So, so I've been doing a lot of catching up on Russian history and where Putin came from. I understand much better, you know, that whole story.
He makes more sense.
Mm-hmm. Much more sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he really does.
So, so that's kind of my other side project, which I'm enjoying, going along at a fairly slow pace. But I hope I can write at least a little book, kind of a novella length book, and, you know, just thoroughly annoy a lot of, you know, ongoing Cold Warriors.
Cold War, how we still have Cold Warriors is another question, but
we're that midst, is really a great question.
We're in the midst of another Russiagate, and it's Cold War. It's crazy.
Ramp up. It is kind of crazy. So now, so we've got to have you back on twice now, Elias.
Talk about your book, when it's out.
Oh, that'd be great.
And talk about your trip to Socialism 2018.
Yeah,
It will be an adventure, I'm sure.
Yeah,
indeed.
All right.
I think.
Are we there?
Pleasure.
I think we're there. Yeah. It's
thank
been a pleasure.
You. Thank you so much for joining us. Short notice, like I said, we've got people we've planned and wanted to have on, but we're just really bad about organizing anything.
Yeah, you know, we're just trying to get through the day here most days.
Yeah.
No, no. You're wonderful. You're an inspiration to us all.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right.
Be well.
You've been listening to the Grace and Paul Podcast. Check out the show blog at podcast.blogspot.com, where you can leave comments or search for the Grace and Paul Podcast on Facebook or YouTube. Bye.
Bye, guys.
See you, Elias.